content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the March 11th, 2016 issue of the Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Trump dominates Super Tuesday as GOP despairs. What happened? Republican Party leaders' hopes of denying Donald Trump the presidential nomination suffered a major blow on Super Tuesday this week, as the billionaire businessman swept to victory in 7 out of 11 states, and none of the other candidates broke out as a clear rival. With an average of 34% of the vote, the longtime frontrunner won comfortably in Alabama, Georgia, Massachusetts, and Tennessee, and secured narrower victories in Arkansas, Vermont, and Virginia. Senator Ted Cruz beat Trump in his home state of Texas and also won Oklahoma and Alaska, and immediately claimed that he was the candidate best suited to stop the bombastic New York businessman. It was a bruising evening for Florida Senator Marco Rubio, who secured his first victory in Minnesota, but finished second in only two states and missed the delegate threshold in three. Ohio Governor John Kasich and retired neurosurgeon Ben Carson failed to win any of the primaries or caucuses. Carson said he saw no path forward and effectively dropped out of the race. With 1,237 delegates needed to clinch the nomination, Trump has amassed 319 and leads Cruz 226, Rubio 110, and Kasich 25. Trump's victory came after a roller coaster week in which he met with growing, even panicky resistance from traditional Republicans. The frontrunner was widely criticized for failing during a TV interview to disavow the endorsement of former Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke, which he later blamed on a faulty earpiece. For the first time, Trump came under blistering attack from Cruz and Rubio, with the Florida senator calling Trump a spray-tanned con man who has defrauded students at his now-closed Trump University, used foreign workers on several building projects, and outsourced his clothing line to Mexico and China. Conservatives, horrified by Trump's rise, pledged not to vote for him in a hashtag Never Trump Twitter campaign. But the real estate mogul also picked up a handful of endorsements from elected Republican officials, most notably his former rival, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. "I'm a unifier," Trump said. "When we unify, there's nobody that's going to beat us." What the editorial said. With its divisive rhetoric and lack of any core governing philosophy, Trump's candidacy may split the GOP in two, said the Wall Street Journal. Yet he will now be hard to stop after demonstrating his breadth across the GOP coalition, winning in New England and the Deep South. Cruz has now won four states, but his religious conservative message hasn't sold well outside the South. Rubio came close in Virginia and did well with late deciding voters in several contests, an indication he's finally gaining momentum. But if he fails to win his home state of Florida on March 15th, he's done. "Sadly, the GOP is taking a big step toward becoming the party of Trump," said the New York Times. Cruz and Rubio have moved far right on immigration and other issues and are now embracing Trump's campaign tactic of character assassination. At a rally last week, Rubio mocked the frontrunner's hair and orange face, joked that he wet his pants during the debate, and made double entendres about the small size of Trump's hands. "With Trump now hijacking their party," said the Boston Globe, "it's time for Republican elected officials to show their cards. Will they support Trump if he's the party nominee? If they truly believe he's as unqualified and dangerous as they're saying, they need to step forward and disavow him now." What the columnist said. "The party's white knight is running out of time," said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com. For months, party leaders have seen Rubio as the one candidate who could tie together enough Republican support to vanquish the American Mussolini. Yet after Rubio's miserable performance on Super Tuesday, he's left with one remotely realistic option. He and the other candidates eke out enough wins to deny Trump a delegate majority, then seize the nomination at a brokered convention in Cleveland. Imagine how Trump's already angry supporters will react to that. "It's not over yet," said John Podhoretz in the New York Post. "The fact that Trump's support hasn't grown since the early states suggests that Rubio's insult barrage and the bully's sulking, childish responses are having an effect on voters." "Trump is weaker than he looks," said Jonathan Last in WeeklyStandard.com. "He has won less than half the delegates allocated so far, and if that trend continues, Trump won't make it to the 1,237. Plus, polls show that only about a quarter of voters had actually heard about his David Duke comments or the scandal over Trump University. Once his rivals and super PACs start spending serious money on negative campaign ads, Trump can be stopped. "You're dreaming," said political consultant Ed Rollins in FoxNews.com. "Like almost everyone else in politics, I was a total skeptic that Trump was a viable candidate. But he has totally dominated a political cycle like no other politician I've seen in decades, tapping into widespread frustration and anger among working class and middle class Americans. If Trump can learn to be a more gracious winner, and he showed movement in that direction after Super Tuesday, he will roll to the nomination and may be a very viable candidate against Hillary Clinton in the fall. As we should have learned by now, you underestimate Trump at your own peril." And our second main story this week, Clinton widens her lead over Sanders. What happened? Hillary Clinton appeared to have a clear path to the Democratic presidential nomination this week after clocking 7 victories over Senator Bernie Sanders in the 11 Super Tuesday states, dominating the South and showing strength in almost every demographic category. Clinton scored landslide wins in Texas, Georgia, Alabama, Virginia, Tennessee, and Arkansas, and narrowly defeated her rival in Massachusetts. The former Secretary of State garnered overwhelming support from African-American voters, who favored her by 83% to 15%, and she held a 67-33 advantage among Latinos. The only group that went for Sanders was white men by 54% to 44%. The self-described Democratic Socialist cruised to victory in his home state of Vermont, while winning Oklahoma, Colorado, and Minnesota. After the string of victories, Clinton now holds a commanding 1,034 to 408 delegate lead, including a massive edge in superdelegates, party leaders who can pledge to a candidate regardless of how their own states vote, with 2,383 delegates required for the nomination. Over the next 2 weeks, the race will move on to several delegate-rich states, including Michigan, Ohio, and Florida, where Clinton leads in the polls. Sanders has vowed to fight on to the Democratic convention in July, but Clinton is already pivoting to a likely general election battle with Republican Donald Trump. "The rhetoric we're hearing on the other side has never been lower," she told cheering supporters in Miami. "Trying to divide America between us and them is wrong, and we're not going to let it work." What the editorial said: maybe Sanders never really had a chance, despite all those earnest millennials who thronged to his rallies, said the Richmond, Virginia Times-Dispatch. But he succeeded in pushing Clinton to the left, forcing her to even renounce the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal negotiated during her tenure as Secretary of State. Of course, Clinton's Wall Street ties hurt her among true believers, but she has the backing of minority voters, and her victory in the Democratic sweepstakes has become inevitable. Her inauguration may be inevitable, too. "It's not over yet," said the Dallas Morning News. With 35 states left to vote, Sanders continues to draw large crowds and raise wads of cash, $43 million in February to Clinton's $30 million. The two candidates have a big challenge ahead of them. to see the primary campaign to its completion without destroying the party's November fortunes. Facing what is likely to be an ugly general election, Sanders can't risk further weakening Clinton, and Clinton can't risk alienating Sanders' devoted young followers. She will need them later. What the columnist said, "Now's the time for Bernie Sanders to get in line," said Michael Tomosky in thedailybeast.com. "That doesn't mean he should drop out. He has the money and the crowds, and his presence keeps Clinton from sail trimming and tacking back to the center too early. But from here on in, Sanders ought to lay off the attacks on Clinton, the Goldman Sachs speeches, and all the rest, because eventually he's going to lose. Sanders can do it in a way that makes him a pivotally powerful senator during a potential Clinton presidency, or in a way that damages her reputation and ultimately his own. Democrats have no reason to celebrate Clinton's inevitable nomination," said Ian Tuttle in NationalReview.com. "She's unlikable. She's a lousy campaigner who has struggled to fend off a challenge from a curmudgeonly socialist. More than half of voters deem her untrustworthy. No wonder she's the subject of three federal investigations. Surveys show that Republicans Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz could beat her in head-to-head matchups. Unfortunately, the GOP seems poised to pick Trump, who has even higher unfavorables than Clinton. Clinton's victories are a tribute to her fortitude and fierceness," said Frank Bruni in the New York Times. "But now her campaign is reportedly crafting a strategy of brutal negativity against Trump, and that may be a mistake. Trump already dwells in the sewer, and by joining him, Clinton can only degrade herself. Instead, she should work harder to attract and inspire those disillusioned Sanders voters who feel the system is rigged, rather than slinging mud and embodying everything they hate about the system. If not, those young Democrats might just sit on the sidelines in November." Our controversy of the week, Supreme Court, the battle over Texas abortion law. "Antonin Scalia's chair is still draped in black crepe," said Robert Barnes in the Washington Post. But at the Supreme Court this week, all eyes were on Justice Anthony Kennedy, whose vote may decide the most important abortion case in decades. At issue is a 2013 Texas law requiring abortion clinics to meet the same building codes and hygiene standards as surgical facilities, and for abortion doctors to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. The cost of compliance has already driven most Texas abortion clinics out of business, leaving only 19 in the entire state to serve 5.4 million women. Other conservative states have passed 250 abortion restrictions over the past 5 years, so the court's ruling could have major national implications. In the past, Kennedy has shown a paternalistic concern with protecting women from choosing abortions they may later regret, said Noah Feldman in BloombergView.com. And in oral arguments this week, he aggressively demanded proof that the law was really forcing clinics to close. Still, more than 100 women submitted briefs to the court, testifying to the vital importance of legal abortion in their own lives. These may strike a chord with Kennedy, who in 1992's Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision wrote that placing an undue burden on women's access to abortion infringed on their personal dignity and autonomy. "Kennedy's respect for dignity cuts both ways," said Erica Bacciocci in NationalReview.com. In his most recent abortion decision, he upheld a ban on a particularly gruesome form of late-term abortion, calling it an affront to the dignity of human life. "That ruling implicitly acknowledges that a pregnant woman is simply not autonomous, but the bearer of unborn life. The Supreme Court has ruled that states can regulate abortion in order to ensure women's maximum safety," said Malie Smith in TheFederalist.com. "Clearly, that would protect Texas common sense requirements that abortion clinics meet the basic standards of other surgical facilities. Don't insult the intelligence of the American people, said Michelle Tang in HuffingtonPost.com. National studies show that legal abortion is roughly 90 times safer than giving birth, which many women choose to do in their own homes. The Texas law, like the ones and ones like it in other states, isn't motivated by a concern for women's health, said Linda Greenhouse in the New York Times. It's in an unguarded moment, Texas Lieutenant Governor tweeted a map of all the clinics that the law would close, adding gleefully that this is why we passed it. The court has already ruled that laws intended to hinder women's access to abortion are unconstitutional, so it must reject Texas law if it is true to its precedents and principles. This is why we already miss Justice Scalia, said Jonathan Tobin in CommentaryMagazine.com. Love him or hate him, Scalia based his decisions on the Constitution and the actual text of written laws. With the court's liberal and conservative blocks now balanced at 4-4, the sentimental Kennedy will be in the spotlight more than ever, with weighty national issues such as abortion decided by which side can best pluck at his heartstrings. If this case ends in a 4-4 tie, Texas abortion law will stand for now, said Jay Michelson in the DailyBeast.com. But the failure to provide a definitive ruling will create legal and political chaos and generate more cynicism about the Supreme Court. As the fight over Scalia's replacement illustrates, justices are now selected based on their personal agendas on hot-button issues such as abortion, not on their commitment to render a dispassionate reading of the Constitution. It was a good week for breaking the silence after Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas asked questions during oral arguments in a case about gun ownership for domestic violence offenders. The first time in 10 years that the conservative jurist has spoken from the bench. It was a good week for calling ahead for reservations. With the opening of a trendy New York restaurant that has just one table for four, along with five bar seats, Mr. Donahue's will serve classics such as roast beef and Swedish meatballs. It was a good week for firsts, after police in Madera Ranchos, California, successfully captured a unicorn. Actually, a pony with a gold horn on its head that had escaped from a children's party. I've been doing this for 14 years, said one officer, and this is my first call for a unicorn. But it was a bad week for Chris Christie, who was widely ridiculed after he stood with a dazed facial expression during Donald Trump's victory speech on Super Tuesday, with some comparing it to a hostage video. Six New Jersey newspapers published a joint editorial calling Christie an utter disgrace for endorsing Trump and demanding he resign. And it was a bad week for pot tourism after the number of ER visits by tourists under the influence of marijuana nearly doubled in the first year of the drug's legalized sale in Colorado. Inexperienced users are evidently consuming too many pot brownies and other edibles. And it was a bad week for customer satisfaction. After New York Knicks star Carmelo Anthony got into an argument with a heckler during the team's 15th loss in 18 games. The owner's right there, Anthony said, pointing to his boss, James Dolan. Ask him for your money back. And on the briefing page, Putin's strongman in Chechnya. Chechen President Ramzan Kadyrov has become a major player in Russian politics. Is he out of control? Who is Kadyrov? Ramzan Kadyrov, 39, is the de facto dictator of the mostly Muslim Russian province of Chechnya. A burly, bearded man with a passion for boxing, Islam, and flattering Instagram photos of himself, he is charismatic and ruthless. Kadyrov rules Chechnya with an iron fist, and those who have endured his prisons say he likes to personally deliver electric shocks to prisoners. He also commands a fiercely loyal 30,000-strong private army that is said to be the best-trained force in Russia. After two devastating separatist wars against Russian forces that killed hundreds of thousands of Chechens, the province was broken and battered when the Kadyrov clan took over. Kadyrov has brought peace and stability for those who don't cross him. He places Islamic Sharia law over Russian law and disdains democracy altogether. "We do not have an opposition," Kadyrov says. "Such a system was invented to undermine authority." In response to growing Russian criticism of his power, Kadyrov last week offered to step down, an offer nearly everyone believes is a ploy. How did he come to power? Russian President Vladimir Putin personally anointed him. Kadyrov's father, Akhmad Kadyrov, was a mufti who declared jihad against Russia in 1995. But was later co-opted by Putin and installed as Chechen president. The elder Kadyrov was assassinated in 2004, and when Ramzan eventually took his place, Putin himself met with Kadyrov to negotiate the terms of their relationship. Because Kadyrov firmly controls a Muslim-majority province that gave Putin nightmares in the past, he enjoys a degree of independence that Putin would not tolerate in any other Russian leader. Kadyrov claims to be fanatically loyal to Putin, and Putin has showered him with awards, including the Hero of Russia Star, the Order of Courage, and the Order for Service to the Homeland. "All those who criticize Putin are subhumans and are my personal enemies," Kadyrov told Newsweek. "As long as Putin supports me, I can do anything." When agents of the National Intelligence Agency, the FSB, arrested several Kadyrov bodyguards accused of torturing a Moscow man in 2013, the bodyguards were quickly freed without a trial, and the lead investigator was fired. Does Kadyrov kill opponents? There's no direct proof of that, but people who cross him tend to end up dead. Russia's most famous investigative journalist, Anna Politkovskaya, who had reported on torture, kidnappings, and murders by Kadyrov's forces, was slain inside her Moscow apartment building in 2006. Natalia Estimirova, a leading activist Kadyrov named to run a human rights council in the Chechen capital of Grozny, was killed outside her apartment in 2009, after she took her job too seriously and exposed abuses by Chechen security. Many Russians believe Kadyrov was also behind the brazen assassination right outside the gates of the Kremlin of top Russian opposition leader Boris Nemtsov. Putin was obviously stunned by that killing, former Kremlin advisor Gleb Pavlovsky told The New Yorker. "If you can do something like this just outside Spassky Gate, then maybe you could do this inside Spassky Gate as well. That is, in the Kremlin itself." How did the government react? The FSB arrested five Chechens, including a deputy commander in Kadyrov's forces. Kadyrov immediately defended the man, praising him on Instagram as a true patriot. Yet the real mastermind, the Russian press said, was Ruslan Geremeyev, a higher-level Chechen commander. Russian investigators wanted to indict him but were forbidden to by their supporters, presumably because Putin wouldn't permit it. Many Russians now think that Putin has lost control of his Chechen attack dog. Why do they think that? Since the Nemtsov murder, Kadyrov has threatened more Russian opposition figures, calling them enemies of the people and traitors, who would be put on trial with maximum severity for sabotage. Former Prime Minister Mikhail Kazyanov, who is now a key opposition leader, called this statement Stalinist. Shortly after that, Kadyrov posted on Instagram a video of Kazyanov and another activist walking together in Strasbourg, France. The video appears to have been taken through the scope of a rifle with crosshairs over the two men. The post produced an outcry in the Russian press. Not a bit embarrassed by his role in the murder of Nemtsov, Kadyrov openly offers Putin his services in the further physical liquidation of the undesirable. Russian political analyst Andrei Pontkovsky tweeted, "Can Kadyrov be stopped? The Russian opposition, such as it is calling for his ouster. Opposition politician Ilya Yashin presented a damning report last week accusing Kadyrov, a frequent visitor to Moscow, of setting his sights beyond Chechnya, and he explicitly asked Putin to remove him. In recent years, Kadyrov's fighters have become active in Moscow, Yashin said. While they see their main task as defending their boss's regime in Chechnya, they are beginning to see the rest of Russia as potential loot. Right after the report came out, Kadyrov announced he was ready to step down as Chechen president if Putin wanted, an offer that may force the Russian president to publicly renew his support of him. So now the ball is in the Kremlin's court, says analyst Brian Whitmore of RFE/RL. Reappointing Kadyrov will only embolden him, but not reappointing him risks a new round of conflict in the North Caucasus. For Putin, both options come with real risk. And it's time to read a few of the best columns. We'll start with one from the U.S. this week. Originalism is based on an illusion. What is a conservative judicial philosophy? Asked Michael Kinsley. The question is playing a large role in the bitter debate over the selection of a Supreme Court justice to replace the late Antonin Scalia. Until recent years, a conservative justice was one who believed in judicial restraint, that is, who uses his or her power sparingly, deferring to democratically elected legislators and presidents and to a judicial precedent. Today, however, most conservatives believe that the job of conservative justices is to impose the conservative agenda on the nation. This kind of conservative halts the Florida recount so that George W. Bush becomes president, and seeks to overturn liberal legislation and previous court decisions won by liberals, such as Roe v. Wade, and voters' rights laws. Scalia was a conservative of this kind, despite his insistence that he had discovered a brilliant new way of interpreting the Constitution, known as originalism, that enabled him to magically discern what the framers meant by every word in the Constitution. What is the meaning of such riddles as due process of law, equal protection under the law, or well-regulated militia? Obviously, that depends on your values, biases, and life experience. Let's stop pretending otherwise. And we'll do two international columns this week. The first from India. Why station soldiers on a glacier? Why are India and Pakistan still patrolling a frozen wasteland? Asked Rajiv Shukla. For decades, the two countries have had hundreds of soldiers stationed on Siachen Glacier high in the Himalayas, where the snow is thick and the temperature never gets above freezing. It's part of the standoff over the disputed territory of Kashmir. But these soldiers fight the elements, not one another. They are taught to survive first. On the Indian side, the infirmary routinely treats soldiers for frostbite, snow blindness, pneumonia, and oxygen deprivation-related conditions. Some troops die. Last month, 10 Indian soldiers on Siachen were crushed in an avalanche. One of them was rescued alive after being trapped under 35 feet of ice for 6 days, but later died in the hospital. Their deaths are senseless. It's time to revive a draft agreement that India and Pakistan clinched but never ratified back in 1989, a pact that there will not be any deployment of forces on Siachen in winter. Instead, we could patrol the area with helicopters and other modern instruments. We've made such an arrangement with China regarding the Ladakh border region, so why can't it be done with Pakistan? That would be a fitting tribute. And from Australia, asylum center is a horror for everyone. Conditions at the Australian Refugee Center on the Pacific island of Nauru are so atrocious that even workers there are suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, said Nicole Hasham. Australia has been detaining asylum seekers in offshore warehouses for years as part of its policy not to allow refugees to set foot on Australian soil. Human rights groups have documented the high rates of physical and mental abuse suffered by detainees, many of them women and children. But now it emerges that even their teachers, carers, and captors are traumatized by their time on Nauru. One guard said that on his first day, he had to respond to an armed riot and cut down a detainee who had tried to hang himself. On his second day, he saw another suicide attempt, another riot, and several sexual assaults. A different worker said that he suffered a breakdown after seeing people slash themselves with razor blades and performing CPR on detainees who'd tried to commit suicide. Refugees have protested their appalling conditions by sewing their lips together. Workers who quit can't escape what they've seen. There is a huge sense of survivor guilt, said one teacher, that I got out, but I've left these people behind, and they are still suffering. Our in-depth article this week, the last word section, is titled Healing Without Drugs. In an echo of Pavlov's famous conditioning experiments, studies show we can train our bodies into thinking we've had medicine. Science journalist Joe Marchant investigates whether we can harness the mind to slash drug costs. Mirette Flies was 11 when her immune system turned against her. A cheerful student from Minneapolis, she had curly brown hair and a pale, moon-shaped face, and she loved playing trumpet. But in 1983, she was diagnosed with lupus, a condition in which the immune system destroys the body's healthy tissues. It ran rampant, attacking her body on multiple fronts. She was given steroids to suppress her immune system. The drugs made her face swell up, and her hair fell out. But despite the treatment, her condition worsened over the next 2 years, causing inflamed kidneys, frequent headaches, seizures, and high blood pressure. By 1985, antibodies were attacking a vital clotting factor in Mirette's blood, causing her to bleed uncontrollably. It got so bad that her doctors considered giving her a hysterectomy because they were worried that when her period started, she might bleed to death. She took drugs, including barbiturates, antihypertensives, diuretics, and steroids, but her blood pressure kept rising. Then her heart started to fail, and her doctors reluctantly decided to give her Cytoxan, an extremely toxic drug. Cytoxan is very good at suppressing the immune system. but it causes vomiting, stomach aches, bruising, bleeding, and kidney and liver damage, and increases the risk of infections and cancer. And at the time, its use in humans was experimental. Karen Olness, a psychologist and pediatrician now at Case Western Reserve University in Ohio, was helping Mariette cope with the stress and pain of her condition, and she was concerned that if lupus didn't kill the teenager, the new drug might. Then Mariette's mother showed Olness a scientific paper she'd seen. The author claimed to have slowed lupus in mice, but with just half the usual dose of Cytoxan. The results were part of a well-known and seemingly mundane phenomenon that has been driving a quiet revolution in immunology. Proponents hope that the process, by allowing doctors to cut drug doses, will not only minimize harmful side effects, but also slash billions from healthcare costs, transforming treatment for conditions such as autoimmune disorders and cancer. The secret? Teaching your body how to respond to a particular medicine so that in the future it can trigger the same change on its own. Ever eaten a favorite food that made you sick? Prawns, say. And discovered that for weeks or months afterward, you couldn't face eating it? This effect is called learned or conditioned taste aversion, and it makes sense. Avoiding foods that have poisoned us in the past protects us from getting ill again. In 1975, Robert Adder, a psychologist at the University of Rochester in New York, was studying taste aversion in rats and got an utterly mystifying result. Adder gave his animals saccharin solution to drink. Rats usually love the sweet taste, but Adder paired the drink with injections of Cytoxan, which made them feel sick. When he later gave the animals the sweetened water on its own, they refused to drink it, just as he expected. So to find out how long the learned aversion would last, he force-fed this harmless drink to them using an eyedropper. But the rats didn't forget. Instead, one by one, they died. After more experiments, Adder concluded that when animals received a saccharin and the drug together, they hadn't just associated the sweet taste with feeling sick. They'd also learned the immunosuppression. Eventually, they'd responded to the sweetened water just as they had to the drug. Even though the second phase of the experiment involved no drug at all, the water Adder fed them suppressed their immune systems so dramatically that they succumbed to fatal infections. In other words, their bodies were reacting to something that wasn't really there just because the circumstances made them expect it. The phenomenon in which we learn to associate a contextual cue with a psychological response is well known. It's called conditioning and was discovered in the 1890s by the Russian physiologist Ivan Pavlov, who noticed that dogs learn to associate his presence with being fed, so that his arrival caused them to salivate even if he had no food. He showed that different signals, such as a buzzer or electric shock, could all be made to trigger the same response. Such learned associations are an important part of our daily lives. Cues prepare the body for important biological events such as eating or sex, and they trigger responses that have evolved to help us avoid or flee from danger. Exposure to a stimulus we associate with a previous allergic reaction, such as a grassy field or fluffy cat, can make us cough or sneeze even if no physical allergen is present. While previously scary situations like a barking dog or an enclosed space can induce a state of flight or fright. Adder's result was revolutionary because it showed that learned associations don't affect just brain-regulated responses like nausea or salivation. His rats proved that these associations influence immune responses too, to the point where a taste or smell can make the difference between life and death. The body's fight against disease, his experiment suggested, is guided by the brain. In fact, a similar discovery has already been made. In the 1920s, Russian researchers at the University of St. Petersburg were following up on Pavlov's work to see which other physiological responses could be conditioned. Among them was immunologist Sergei Metelnikov. Instead of suppressing the immune system as Atterwood, Metelnikov wanted to boost it. In one experiment, he repeatedly warmed guinea pig skin, at the same time gave them injections that triggered an immune response. Then he gave them another group of unconditioned guinea pigs a normally lethal dose of Vibrio cholerae bacteria while warming both groups' skin. The unconditioned animals died within 8 hours, whereas the conditioned ones survived an average of 36 hours, and some of them recovered completely. Their response to a learned cue, heat, appeared to have saved their lives. In a 1982 study, Atter used conditioning to treat mice that had a lupus-like disease. He trained them to associate cytoxin with a saccharin solution, just as in his original experiment. After they learned the association, he kept giving the mice sweetened water along with half the usual drug dose for lupus. Compared with mice that received the same dose but weren't conditioned, they lived longer and their disease progressed more slowly. This was the paper that Moret's mother had seen. Karen Olness telephoned Atter and asked, would his conditioning work on Moret? Could they train her immune system to respond to a lower cytoxin dose than normal, sparing her the worst of the drug's toxicity? Atter agreed to try. The first question was what taste to use. We had to choose something that was unique that she hadn't experienced before, said Olness. She considered vinegars, horehound, eucalyptus chips, and various liqueurs before finally settling on a combination of rose perfume and cod liver oil. Moret's treatment started the next morning. She sipped the cod liver oil as cytoxin flowed through an IV line into a vein in her foot. Meanwhile, Olness uncapped the rose perfume and waved it around the room. They repeated this bizarre ritual once a month for the next 3 months. After that, Moret was exposed to cod liver oil and perfume every month, but received cytoxin only every third month. By the end of the year, she had received just 6 doses of the drug instead of the usual 12. Moret responded as well as her doctors would have hoped for from the full drug regimen. The clotting factor reappeared, and her blood pressure returned to normal. She went to college, where she played trumpet in the school band. At 9 o'clock every morning and evening, an alarm goes off on Barbara Nowak's mobile phone. When she hears it, the 46-year-old geologist sits down at her kitchen table in Sprockhovel, northern Germany, and takes a powerful cocktail of immunosuppressant drugs. But today there's a change in her routine. Before swallowing the pills, she downs a drink. It's sweet, bitter, neon green, and tastes strongly of lavender. In 1988, when she was 19, Nowak lost her kidneys to lupus. Receiving a donated kidney transformed her health. It's another life, she said. But there's a downside. She's dependent on twice-daily medication to suppress the immune responses that would destroy her transplant, drugs that slowly poison the very organ she's trying to save. So Nowak is drinking this gaudy concoction as part of a pioneering trial. The green drink is an updated version of Moret's rose and cod liver oil, invented to test conditioned responses. Manfred Shedlowski, a medical psychologist at the University of Essen in Germany, wanted something strange and unforgettable that stimulates several senses at once. He hit on strawberry milk mixed with green food coloring and essential oil. Its bright color and overwhelming lavender flavor create a bewildering mix of sensory cues. So far, Shedlowski has shown that after the drink is associated with CSA, a drug similar to cytoxin, it reliably induces immunosuppression in healthy volunteers, creating on average 60 to 80% of the effects of the drug, but will it work in sick patients? In the learning phase of the study, Nowak drank the lavender milk alongside her drugs, morning and evening for 3 days. Then, after a 2-day break, came the evocation phase, using the drink to try to amplify the effect of her medication. She again downed the drink with her drugs, but also drank it 2 extra times during the day, along with a placebo pill. A 2013 trial was promising. In all 4 patients, adding the green drink suppressed immune cell proliferation by up to 40% more than drugs alone. Now Nowak is part of a larger study of about 20 patients. If that works too, the next step will be to test whether the conditioned response can be maintained while doses start to be reduced. Besides helping with organ transplants, there's a plethora of uses that conditioning might have by reducing harmful side effects or simply making treatment more cost-effective. Other possibilities include the relief of allergies and autoimmune conditions. Adder carried out a small study in 1996 that paired Cytoxan with aniseed-flavored syrup in 10 people who had multiple sclerosis. When later given the syrup alongside a placebo pill, 8 of them responded with immunosuppression similar to that produced by the active drug. In another study, published shortly before he died in 2011, Adder reported that quarter or half doses of corticosteroid ointment plus conditioned response could control psoriasis just as well as a full drug dose. Animal studies hint that the approach might also be useful in the treatment of some cancers. Researchers at the University of Alabama, Birmingham have trained mice to associate the taste of camphor with a drug that activates white blood cells that attack tumors. Then they transplanted aggressive tumors into the mice. The animals given doses of camphor survived longer than those treated with immunotherapy, and in one experiment, 2 mice defeated their cancer altogether, despite receiving no active drug. Years of research are required before conditioning regimens for cancer or transplant patients reach the clinic, but Shedlowski says the principle could be used much sooner to reduce drug doses for conditions such as asthma or arthritis. Someone could be prescribed a suitable drug, and after 2 or 3 weeks of taking it regularly, could switch to a pack in which real pills were interspersed with identical placebos. But the idea is not widely accepted. Reducing drug doses isn't attractive to drug companies, but a wider problem is that for most doctors and scientists, the concept of treatments with no pharmaceutical component just makes no sense. Shedlowski is steadfastly optimistic that the benefits of conditioning are too great to ignore. 10 years ago, nobody believed us, he says. Now journals are much more open-minded to this kind of approach. Still, there's a long way to go. Adder remains barely known even among immunologists. Shedlowski leads one of the only teams researching conditioned immune response. "I'd like to say we're the best in the world," he jokes, "because there is nobody else." This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in mosaicscience.com. On the health and science page, oceans rising faster than ever. Sea levels are climbing more rapidly than they have in almost 3,000 years, largely as a consequence of greenhouse gas emissions related to human activities, a new study shows. Researchers used statistical models to reconstruct sea levels for the past 2,800 years. We can say with 95% probability that the 20th century rise was faster than any of the previous 27 centuries, said study leader Bob Kopp of Rutgers University. Global temperatures have jumped 1.8 degrees Fahrenheit since the 19th century, and climatologists say that warming has melted polar ice caps enough to cause an overall sea level rise of 5.5 inches. More along the U.S. sea East Coast. That increase has already led to frequent coastal flooding in Florida, Virginia, and other states. The prognosis is not encouraging. As glaciers melt and ocean waters expand, sea levels will keep on rising faster. If emissions continue unabated, researchers calculate that sea levels could rise as much as 4 feet by 2100, forcing the abandonment of many coastal communities. But even if action is taken that leads to significantly lower emissions, the conservative estimate is that sea levels will swell by 2 feet. We can definitely be confident that sea level rise is going to continue to accelerate if there's further warming, researcher Stefan Ramsdorf tells the New York Times, which inevitably there will be. Coffee's protective effect. People who overindulge in alcohol and food risk serious damage to their livers. But a new study suggests that they might benefit from an extra cup of Joe, the Washington Post reports. New researchers found that drinking more coffee could help safeguard the liver, which is crucial to many metabolic processes. Researchers analyzed data from 9 previously published studies, encompassing more than 430,000 participants, and found that drinking 2 additional cups of coffee a day was associated with a 44% lower risk of developing cirrhosis. A potentially fatal condition with no cure, cirrhosis involves the hardening and destruction of liver tissue and kills more than 1 million people a year worldwide. Apart from alcohol consumption, cirrhosis may be caused by hepatitis infections, immune disorders, and fatty liver disease, which is tied to obesity and diabetes. How Java works its magic on the liver is unclear, but study author Oliver Kennedy says it's nice to know that you can get such large benefits from a cheap, ubiquitous, and well-tolerated beverage. And moving right into the talking points, Guantanamo, does it still serve a purpose? It's about time, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. If Congress hadn't decided long ago to resist nearly all President Obama's initiatives, there would be scant opposition to his plan to shut down the prison at Guantanamo Bay. The president last week proposed to moving up to 56 of the 91 remaining detainees to maximum security federal prisons in South Carolina, Kansas, and Colorado. The other 35 or so detainees would be sent to other countries. Critics fear the move would endanger Americans. The terrorist will somehow escape or spread jihadist propaganda among other inmates. But 349 convicted terrorists, including 9/11 plotter Zacharias Moussaoui, already reside in U.S. maximum security prisons, where many spend 23 hours in solitary, leaving little opportunity for proselytizing or escape. Let's finally close the abusive extra-legal prison camp at Gitmo, which serves as a recruiting tool for jihadists and represents an assault on America's standing as a beacon of justice. There's nothing shameful about Gitmo, said Joe Connor in NationalReview.com. I visited the facility as a family member of a 9/11 victim, and I've seen the dozens of unrepentant terrorists there get more due process rights than most Americans could imagine. Free legal counsel, prayer mats, access to secret government information, and the chance to delay their trials indefinitely. In the past, the enemy fighters there, including 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, would have been hanged. The claim that Gitmo is a major recruitment tool for radical Islam is false, said former U.S. intelligence officer Jim Warashuk in AmericanThinker.com. Intelligence agencies have found no evidence to support this myth, which was fabricated by people sympathetic to Islamists. Besides, why would anyone in the Islamic world who objects to Gitmo be less offended if we locked up the same terrorist inside Supermax prisons on U.S. soil? This is a moot debate, said Amber Phillips in the Washington Post. Obama's proposal to close Gitmo has no chance of getting through the Republican-controlled Congress, which since 2009 has refused to give the commander-in-chief the funding needed to move detainees to U.S. courts and prisons. Obama's best option is to keep whittling down the detainees until perhaps 35 or so are left languishing in Cuba for the next president to deal with. Obama began his presidency with 245 detainees, so leaving with just three dozen ain't bad. And a couple of short notes here. Let's see. Beijing has replaced New York as the billionaire capital of the world, having acquired 32 new billionaires last year. The Chinese capital now has 100 billionaires compared with New York's 95. Moscow is third with 66 billionaires. Almost 20% of Donald Trump supporters disapprove of Abraham Lincoln's executive order that freed all the slaves in the Confederacy. And another 17% said they weren't sure, according to a recent YouGov poll. Scott Kelly has just completed 340 days in space, crushing the previous NASA record of 215 consecutive days. During his stay at the International Space Station, Kelly witnessed 10,944 sunrises and sunsets, covered 143 million miles, or roughly the distance of a one-way trip to Mars, and drank 193 gallons of recycled urine and sweat. On the poll watch, just 26% of Americans support President Obama's plan to close Guantanamo Bay. 56% want the prison to remain operational, and 18% aren't sure. We'll finish today's reading with a quote from Milton Berle, quoted in bookreporter.com. He says, "If opportunity doesn't knock, build a door." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.